Colin Livingston joins us once again. And Colin, obviously the major story in the racing world right now is none other than Roger Penske has purchased IndyCar and Indianapolis Raceway, you know, the Raceway, whatever, but IndyCar, now he has cars in it, correct, but now he owns the whole thing. Is this a good thing for IndyCar? Is there a conflict of interest? What are the racers, what are people in the IndyCar world saying?
I mean, fans are overwhelmingly supportive. The teams have come out. They're overly supportive. Roger Penske uniformly has a reputation that, you know, pretty much everything he touched turns to gold. He's a super ethical, honest, hardworking, but more than anything, really, really brilliant business person that, you know, like anything, like when the last, you know, collective bargaining agreement happened in the NHL, things didn't change overnight. There was a bunch of new rules, but it took years for the new changes to implement before, you know, things really started to turn around. And I hope people can, you know, be a little bit patient. Things aren't going to change on a dime within IndyCar, but mark my words, over the next couple of years, the series will be in a lot stronger shape. And, you know, across the board, fan experience at the track, the TV package should improve. You know, there should be theoretically more money for teams. That's always been a big concern because the overwhelming amount of purse money is paid for the Indy 500 and then subsequently, you know, relatively nothing paid for the balance of the races. But yeah, overwhelmingly positive.
How do you think he'll be able to, like, it's great because we had a lot of text already. Is this going to improve the TV deal? Because if you didn't know, you basically couldn't watch IndyCar in Canada this year. It's almost impossible to find. So I'm assuming that's something. Or is the TV deal, I don't know, is it still in place for next year so it can't change immediately, or could he improve it by next season already?
It's something they're going to have to start working on. Hopefully there's a Canadian you know, sports entity, whether it's Sportsnet, TSN, MAV TV, one of the motorsports outlets that will actually be able to put something together. I don't know that their focus is going to be on Canada necessarily, but they will certainly you know, start working on a better deal, try and get to a major network instead of being on, you know, in the States, it's NBC Sportsnet, which isn't, you know, a widely covered, you know, it's more of a cable network than a major network. But yeah, I mean, the changes are going to start very quickly, but whether their impact is felt immediately or not remains to be seen.
It's kind of a transitional time, obviously, for, I believe, but, you know, we've talked about before that it has lost some of its luster, that racing formula. So if I were to give you the carte blanche, what would be the first couple of things you do to get this transition back to where it is maybe in Europe, a higher profile sport?
If I could, I mean, I can come up with a lot of things, and I'll throw a few things at you, but yeah, if I really knew how to do it, we wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be running IndyCar, sure, or, you know, one of the other racing series. I think a long time ago, the series used to exist on tobacco money and alcohol money. And when that really got restricted and eliminated, the series in general didn't learn how to adapt. Formula One has figured out a way around it. NASCAR, I don't think, has really got their way around it. And IndyCar has definitely not figured out how to exist and build a model that's successful for their teams without that massive influx of money from tobacco companies. Roger Penske and Penske Racing has always managed to raise the funds, though. Like, they're very well funded. They put awesome packages together and they give great returns. And my benchmark for sponsorship and my benchmarks for who does the right thing with their teams are the guys that can maintain and retain sponsorship for a period of time. The teams you see perpetually flipping over sponsors are people that, you know, they write a check, they get promised maybe a bill of goods, the end product isn't what they wanted, or the B2B deal that was supposed to happen doesn't, and then, you know, it opens the door for a lot of shyster-type guys to come in with big plans of marketing that never really go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Penske Racing, you take a look at their long-term sponsors, and they keep their people on. You know, I've told the story before on this show, when we did a race with Penske, we ended up getting invited to their Christmas party because our NASCAR banquet was the same weekend. And Mr. Penske came up to speak to everyone. There were 500 plus people in his shop, one of the best parties I've ever been to. And he said, you guys might notice that I was a little late getting here today, and you know how firm I am. Like, he's super militant on punctuality, dress code, manners. Like, he's a real old school gentleman type. And he said, I have to apologize, but for those of you who don't know, I spent my week up in Michigan with one of our machining partners, and I think it was Haas, trying to negotiate the loan or the donation of an $80,000 machine that they wanted to do a certain thing within their machine shop. Mr. Penske's net worth is reported to be somewhere in the $12 to $15 billion range, yeah. And he still spent a week's worth of time to negotiate because he knew that if he could get an $80,000 machine, yeah, that's $80,000 he's got for something else. But it always comes with a trade-off. You get the machine, but then you have to extend what you offer back, yeah, to that sponsor. He's done it better than anyone else in racing, frankly. It's really going to be exciting, but again, I hope fans specifically can temper their expectations that, you know, it's not going to be a brand new car next year. It's not going to be a brand new, engine supplier is not going to come in next year, but there are things that are going to be worked on for the future. And, really, as far as stewardship goes, and that was a word that was used an awful lot in all the press releases, there is no better person that could be built than Mr. Penske.
Taking a look at the world of racing with the Cantrac Race Report. Colin Livingston here joins us. Colin, you sent over a video and it went through the entire steering wheel of an F1. And so I was really interested. Videos you always send are more on the side of the racing. Right. This was a pure equipment. And I couldn't believe the detail and the complexity of the steering wheel. It was fit to the guy's hands. I mean, I was blown away in that. What did they say? They have to make 50 gear changes per lap?
That was at one particular track. Some tracks are even more than that. So they'll run up and down 50 shifts.
So how much time does it take a racer to get used to everything that's going on that? Because even one button, it also shows you reverse. But you have to hold it down or something. Right. It's a crazy, crazy thing.
Yeah, I mean, most of these drivers, the development of the steering wheels, it's been an evolution for a number of years. That, like, F1 wheels weren't like that forever. They used to just be a steering wheel, and the gear shift lever was actually over on the side. They still had to depress a clutch pedal for a long time. So the cars have definitely evolved. It'll take hours for a guy to really go through and figure out. But nowadays, as they evolve, they put more logic into it. So the funny thing is they talk about going through everything that the steering wheel does, but they don't. They only went through about four different elements of the steering wheel. They showed the strat button, which is basically the quote-unquote strategy button, and you get to figure out there's 15 different settings. So that's what's known as engine mapping or the engine power. So they can actually add power for things like qualifying. They can take it away where you've got a lead or you know you can't catch the other car, so you start saving fuel or you save wear and tear on the engine. They talked about the differentials. So the differentials, you've got a diff in the front and a diff in the back, and you can actually adjust the differentials so that if you go to turn in on, you know, turn into a corner, so corner entry, and your front end wants to slip, so, you know, you've got what's called understeer, you can adjust the differential so it provides more, more differential power, which will change the way the car enters the corner. You can change the mid-range on a different setting and then the exit. So those were the couple of things they showed, but they didn't show, I've been trying to find out, there's two buttons on the Mercedes steering wheels, but they're on the back, and I'm trying to find out what those buttons do, and I haven't been able to find the answer. But then you can make chassis adjustments, wing adjustments, brake balance adjustment, and why I started looking at that stuff is because Lewis Hamilton was drastically outqualified by his teammate, and drastically being 0.3 seconds. There were two drivers within hundredths, and then the third place and fourth place drivers were whiskers off. But it was Hamilton's teammate that won the pole, and Hamilton was nowhere to be found. And, you know, Lewis took it onto himself and said, listen, I just didn't have it today. I haven't been comfortable in the car. I don't really know where the speed was lost. And what it turned out to be is there's a little plastic ridge that changes the engine braking, so the amount of impact the engine has as you decelerate the car. What was happening is his was broken, so as he was turning, he was actually adjusting the engine braking out of a range, and you won't see it on the steering wheel because you're in the middle of a corner, you're focused on the corner. When they're making the majority of these adjustments to brake balance, engine braking, you know, differentials, as while they're in a straightaway, he was actually adjusting it down, and then as he straightened out, he adjusted it back, which was killing his corner entry, and that's where we lost all that speed. So I wanted to go through and kind of get a little bit more educated. They don't talk about it a lot in the broadcasts. The broadcasts are really excellent, but these are the things that I find fascinating. And these guys will go through, you know, aside from 50 shifts, they make upwards of 20 different adjustments to brake balance, engine, and differential per lap. So, yeah, they're very, very busy as they're traveling. Like Mexico, I saw a peak speed of 360 kilometers an hour, so just about 320 miles an hour, and they're making all these changes.
Not a real big surprise. Hamilton wins the title, but Harvick gets into the final. Yeah. Let's quickly kind of recap NASCAR. We only got about 45 seconds at one of your favorite tracks this weekend.
Love Phoenix International. I haven't been back since they reconfigured it. A couple of years ago, they took out a bunch of seats, built a bunch of new grandstands, new suites, and they moved the start-finish line from one side of the track to the other to make the track a little bit more racy. It's going to be an awesome race. I usually don't get too excited for NASCAR, but the Phoenix race is just one that, you know, especially for Edmontonians, it's easy to get to. It's a 3-hour flight. Tickets are always available. And the hospitality in Arizona is really awesome.
Colin, always great stuff. Just one last one for you.
Sure.
Hey, guys, all this mention of Penske has me running through the Seinfeld episode. You're not Penske material from Sandwich Dan. So we'll see if he says that to anyone or not now that he owns IndyCar. It'll be very interesting. We'll get more into Hinchcliffe because it doesn't look like there's any solution for the Canadian driver, unfortunately, unless something kind of really comes out of left field. So maybe we'll touch on that next week.
Running out of time, but hopefully.